So imagine a painting of a dog, just, a simple watercolor. Now, track this physical piece of paper as it travels over 9,000 kilometers.
Which is quite the trip for a piece of paper.
Right, exactly. It starts its life in this quiet, incredibly private studio in Whittier, California, and eventually finds itself hanging on the wall of a gallery all the way over in Zug, Switzerland.
And, I mean, that transcontinental journey is impressive, but the most extraordinary thing about this painting really isn't the distance it traveled.
No, it's not. It's this stubborn, deliberate, almost rebellious decision the artist made before he even picked up a brush. He completely refused to make the dog look cute.
Which goes against pretty much every modern instinct we have when we depict our animal companions, you know. We want the big eyes, the goofy smile. We want that instant emotional payoff.
We want the awe factor. I mean, we are so conditioned for it, but this refusal changes the entire experience of the artwork. We are looking at a watercolor piece titled Estella, painted by Jarrow Duke in November of 2022 and then exhibited the following summer.
And you might think this is just, well, a standard walkthrough of a pet portrait, but to actually understand why this painting matters, we have to look past the frame.
Because we have an incredible stack of sources for this deep dive. We have the artist's private diaries, his self-critiques, the actual technical chemistry of his paint, and an underlying philosophy about what it actually means to share your home with an animal.
Yeah, having access to an artist's private notes while they're right in the middle of a project is so rare. We aren't just looking at a polished gallery label.
Right, we're seeing the messy stuff.
Exactly. We are seeing the doubts, the physical struggles with the materials, and the incredibly specific choices being made in that Whittier studio.
So to get to the emotional weight of this painting, I think we actually have to start with physical weight, like the literal foundation of the piece.
Emotion requires a physical anchor, for sure.
Yeah, so let's look at the technical sheet. The painting is 15 by 11 inches. He's using Daniel Smith watercolors. And the canvas is Arches cold-pressed, rough grain paper. But the detail that really jumps out to me is the density. It's 640 gram paper.
Which is huge. The paper choice is a massive tell here. It signals the kind of battle the artist was preparing to fight with the water.
Okay, let's unpack this for the listener. Let's put 640 grams into perspective. Standard printer paper, the stuff sitting in your office tray right now, that's about 80 grams.
Right. Very thin.
And if you go to an art store and buy standard watercolor paper, which already feels pretty thick, you are usually holding 300 gram paper. At 640 grams, we are talking about a material that is almost as dense and rigid as heavy cardboard.
It's intense.
It is. If standard paper is a sponge, this 640 gram paper is a reservoir. But why on earth does a 15 by 11 inch painting of a resting dog require the structural integrity of a cardboard box? Isn't that just overkill?
Well, what's fascinating here is that it comes down to the fundamental physics of watercolor as a medium. Watercolor is notoriously untamable because its primary vehicle is just that, it's water.
And water wants to do what water wants to do.
Exactly. It wants to flow, it wants to pool, and most importantly, it wants to warp whatever it touches. I mean, paper is essentially just a woven mat of tiny plant fibers, right?
Yeah.
So when you introduce a massive amount of water to thin, 80 gram or even 300 gram paper, those plant fibers soak up the moisture and they swell.
They expand outward.
They expand. But because they are densely woven and bound together in a flat sheet, they eventually run out of horizontal room to expand into. They literally have nowhere left to go that up.
Oh, wow. So the paper just buckles under the pressure.
It violently warps. It creates these little unpredictable hills and valleys all across your canvas.
And I imagine once your canvas is full of literal hills, the colored pigment just slides right down into the valleys and forms these ugly, muddy puddles.
Exactly. And the illusion of the painting is completely ruined because you, as the viewer, are suddenly very aware that you're just looking at wet, warped paper.
So a 640 gram paper is basically a beast of a material designed specifically to stop that from happening.
It's so thick and heavily bound that you can throw massive sweeping washes of water onto it, and it just takes it. It won't buckle. It acts like a concrete driveway, just holding the water perfectly flat.
That makes so much sense.
And beyond just staying flat, a paper this thick actually alters the environment of the painting process itself. It absorbs so much moisture that it locally maintains the ambient humidity of the studio for a much longer time.
Oh, so it doesn't dry out immediately.
Right. It dries incredibly slowly, and that gives the artist a wider, way more forgiving window to manipulate the paint before it sets into the fibers.
Okay, but the technical sheet also specifies rough grain. So it's thick, but it's not smooth like glass, right?
Far from it. The surface is practically a microscopic landscape of its own. It's full of tiny textures, little peaks and crevices.
So how does that interact with the paint?
Well, when the watery paint washes over it, the heavy pigment naturally settles down into those microscopic valleys, while the peaks of the paper remain slightly lighter. It gives the dried paint this vibrating, breathing texture. The paper isn't just a passive surface.
It's an active collaborator.
Exactly. It's working with him.
And that active collaboration between the textured paper and the heavy water, that is exactly what allows the artist to break away from the standard rules of how we usually draw animals.
Right. It lets him avoid the rigid traps of a biological illustration.
Yeah, because the composition here is an extreme, highly intimate close-up of Estella. And Estella is a French bulldog. She is resting her heavy head directly on her front paws.
And the way he captures the gravity of her body is fascinating. Because he isn't doing it by studying a veterinary manual. He isn't meticulously measuring the distance between the skull and the shoulder blade to get the proportions scientifically perfect.
Right. His notes make it very clear he is actively rejecting that kind of cold academic anatomy. He is relying on tactile memory.
Tactile memory, yes.
It's the profound difference between knowing how a dog's skeleton is put together and knowing the exact familiar feeling of a dog resting its heavy, sleepy head on your leg for the thousandth time.
It's such a specific feeling.
He is painting the sensation of gravity, the feeling of a body that completely, implicitly trusts the environment it's resting in.
And to translate that feeling of trust and softness onto the page, he exercises incredible technical restraint. In his diaries, he actually describes his drawing technique as a whispered stroke.
A whispered stroke. I love that.
Because in watercolor, if you rely on thick, heavy outlines to define the shape of an arm or a face, it immediately looks like a coloring book. Hard lines trap the figure and flatten it out.
Okay, wait, I have to push back on this premise a little bit.
Yeah.
Because he is painting Estella, and French bulldogs have incredibly deep wrinkles, very prominent heavy features, and a really dark snout.
They do, yeah.
So if you are painting a dark, wrinkly dog, but you stubbornly refuse to use hard lines or pure black paint, aren't you just sort of tying your hands behind your back on purpose? Like, how do you even paint a dark snout without black?
It does sound like tying your hands behind your back, but it's actually about deeply understanding the optics of watercolor. Pure, opaque black paint basically acts as a visual black hole on the canvas.
A black hole.
Yeah, it completely kills the light. And in oil painting, you can paint light on top of dark. But in watercolor, the brilliance and the light actually come from the white of the paper itself, shining up through the translucent paint.
Oh, I see. So if you throw down a heavy layer of pure black, you block the paper.
You block the light entirely.
And the shadows just look dead and flat.
Exactly. So instead of using flat black, the artist modulates the dark tones using a technique called velador, or transparent layers.
Like glazing.
Very much like glazing. He builds up the deeply dark areas of the dog's snout and wrinkles with successive, really thin layers of color. So maybe a dark blue, then a deep brown, then a heavy purple.
But they stay see-through.
Right, because these layers remain slightly translucent, the pristine white of that thick 640-gram paper underneath can still catch the light in the room and bounce it back up through the layers of pigment to your eye.
Wow. So the shadows aren't dead. They actually vibrate with subtle, warm, and cool tones. The color literally breathes.
It does. It keeps the piece alive.
So if the entire painting relies on the white of the paper to generate light, how does that dictate the rest of the environment? Like, where is she resting? Let's look at the background of the piece because it's entirely undefined.
Right. There's no distinct setting.
There is no couch. There's no patterned rug. There isn't a lamp or a dog bed. It is not a geometric, measurable room. But she doesn't look like she's just floating in a white void either.
And that's very intentional. The background isn't meant to be a literal physical place. The artist explicitly notes that the space behind her is designed to, quote, contain like a home does.
Contain like a home does.
He is painting a thermal sensation of safety. I mean, think about a powerful memory of feeling safe as a child in your own home. You probably don't remember the exact dimensions of the furniture or the architectural layout of the room.
No, not at all.
You remember the warmth. You remember the feeling of being contained and protected.
Which brings that thermal sensation right up to the absolute focal point of the painting, which is Estella's eyes. And this is where it gets really interesting.
Her expression is so compelling.
It is. The refusal to take the easy technical route, you know, refusing to use pure black or hard outlines, it perfectly mirrors a deeper refusal to take the easy emotional route with the audience.
How so?
Well, she is looking slightly upward from her resting position on her paws, but it is a highly calculated ambiguity. She is deliberately not making direct eye contact with the viewer.
Right, she's looking slightly inward, maybe in a state of half sleep, or perhaps she's just passively watching a family member moving around outside the frame of the painting.
But she is absolutely not seeking your attention. And the artist explains this choice in his notes with just a highly distilled piece of philosophy. He wrote, "Estella doesn't pose, she waits."
Estella doesn't pose, she waits. That is so profound.
Think about the distinction there. Posing is inherently performative. When you pose for a camera, you are intentionally altering your natural behavior to satisfy the person observing you.
Because posing is a transaction. You're giving them what they want.
Exactly.
But waiting is a state of being. Waiting is remaining completely true to your own nature, regardless of who happens to be watching.
And for you listening, think about your social media feeds. The internet algorithm practically demands the exact opposite of what this painting is doing. We have been so conditioned to crave huge begging eyes.
Oh, absolutely.
We want viral cuteness. We want pecs put in little outfits, making human-like expressions to give us an immediate dopamine hit awe. We demand that the animal performs for us.
We humanize them for our own entertainment.
Yes. And Jairo Duque is actively denying you, the viewer, that cheap, immediate gratification.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that denial is really a radical act of respect. By refusing to caricature the dog, by refusing to force it to mimic a human child, just so it can be easily digested and loved by an audience, the artist is granting the animal true dignity.
He lets her just be a dog.
Exactly. He acknowledges that the animal has its own way of existing in the world, distinct from ours, and that its existence has profound value entirely on its own terms.
It doesn't need to entertain us to be worthy of a portrait.
And that's the fundamental difference between prepackaged sentimentality and mature art. Sentimentality gives you an immediate, easy feeling that fades the moment you scroll past it. Mature art asks you to pause, observe, and meet the subject on its own terms.
And this demand for mature observation over a cheap reaction is something the artist also points inward. We see a really vulnerable moment in his private notes where he turns that exact same demanding critical lens onto himself in his studio.
Artists are always their own worst critics.
So true. He looks at the finished piece, a piece that successfully traveled to a gallery in Switzerland, mind you, and he delivers a rather harsh autocritique. He writes that, in retrospect, he wishes he had risked more. Specifically, he wishes he had utilized a technique known as lost edges.
Now, a lost edge is a highly sophisticated optic technique in painting. It happens when the light and shadow value of the subject, so for example, the shadow top of Estella's head, perfectly matches the value of the background directly behind it.
Right. They're exactly as dark or exactly as light as each other.
Exactly. And when those values are identical, a master painter will simply stop drawing the boundary. They let the edge disappear entirely. They allow the colors of the subject and the background to just bleed together.
They basically just leave a blank space where the outline should be.
They do. And they rely entirely on the viewer's brain to intuitively bridge the gap and complete the invisible shape.
That is so risky, though.
It is, but the artist noted that if he had let those boundaries melt away completely, particularly between the dog's head and that warm thermal background, he would have fused Estella even more deeply into her home container.
Right. It would have amplified the sensation of absolute rest, making her practically melt into the safety of the room.
It's an incredible insight.
It honestly reminds me of music. It's like listening to a virtuosic jazz musician review their own flawless guitar solo. They listen to the playback, and their only takeaway is, I should have played fewer notes.
So the silence could speak.
Yes. He wanted to literally paint less so he could say more.
And that concept of silent speaking is actually part of a much larger conversation happening within his body of work. Estella doesn't exist in a vacuum. The artist's notes reveal that this painting is in direct, deliberate dialogue with another piece he painted, titled Frida.
Oh, right. They are companion pieces, so they basically represent two halves of a whole. If Estella is the silence, what is Frida?
Well, the painting of Frida is meant to represent active presence. Frida embodies alert energy. Think of the dog with its ears pricked up, muscles tense, acting as the guardian at the door, basically vibrating with the need to engage with the world.
While Estella, on the other hand, represents incarnated stillness. a heavy, breathing weight melting into the floorboards.
Right. And together, these two paintings articulate the artist's holistic view on family dynamics and the hidden roles animals play within them.
Because the true magic of family, and really the true gift of sharing your life with a pet, isn't always found in the loud, active events.
No, it rarely is.
It's not just the frantic playtime at the park, or the barking at the mailman, or, you know, the performing of tricks. It is found in the continuous, silent, completely unremarkable fabric of an ordinary Tuesday afternoon.
It is the quiet act of simply being, of accompanying.
Of physically supporting the space when absolutely nothing extraordinary is happening.
It's the silent infrastructure of a home, that steady rhythmic heartbeat resting on the floorboards while you just go about your day washing dishes or reading a book.
So what does this all mean? We started with a heavy 640-gram piece of woven paper in a studio in California. We added water, microscopic valleys of texture, and carefully layered translucent pigments that refused to rely on the heavy crutch of black paint.
It's a lot of physical material to convey an emotion.
It really is. And we saw an artist deliberately turn his back on viral cuteness and social media algorithms, choosing instead to honor the quiet, non-human dignity of a resting bulldog. And through all of that, a profound testament to the silent pillars of our family lives emerged.
I think when technique is honest, it makes the invisible visible.
Hmm.
But thinking about his autocritique, you know, his desire to use more lost edges to blend the resting subject perfectly into its home, it leaves me with a thought that extends far beyond just the mechanics of watercolor.
Oh, where does it apply?
Well, in our hyper-connected, constantly performing modern lives, we often feel this intense pressure to loudly prove our presence. We feel the need to fix things, to communicate constantly, to entertain the people we love, basically to pose for them.
We're always performing.
Exactly. But what if we practice the emotional equivalent of a lost edge in our human relationships?
Letting the boundaries blur.
Blurring the boundaries of our own egos. Blurring our own relentless need to perform until we simply become a safe, silent, undemanding background for someone else. What if the most profound way to love someone isn't to entertain them, but just to be the warm container they can comfortably rest in without ever asking them to pose for us?
Practicing the lost edge in our own lives, the ultimate act of silent support. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. The next time you walk past your own silent companion, whether they've traveled 9,000 kilometers or just from the couch to the kitchen, I hope you see their quiet dignity and the space they hold in your home just a little bit differently. We'll see you next time.